and unsurpassed penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. What a beautiful day. So we'll continue. It's a practice period, and I've been a little remiss. Those people that signed up for it, I'll send you a little time when we can get together. Try to schedule some time when we can get together for practice discussion. But some people I'll be able to see today. We're going to continue to do a half day sitting out of my house. Mm-hmm. So if you want to join us, you're more than welcome to do that. We're going to do a little stone soup, right? But if you know, you don't have to bring anything if you haven't signed up. But if you wanted to stop and get something, even just a little fruit or a couple of cookies or something to share for lunch, that'd be great. So we'll start at about 11:15 at my house. It's a beautiful day today, so we'll have a few periods of sitting, walk out in the garden, and then we'll end at around 2:00. We'll have tea together, maybe a little discussion for about a half an hour. And there's some directions. If you don't know how to get out to my house, there's direct printed directions outside. It's about 10 minutes away, out towards Occidental. And again, you're welcome to join us. There's also the retreat, the St. Dorothy's Retreat, which starts Friday night, ends on Sunday. And there's a sign-up sheet out there. And if you've signed up, your deposit ensures your registration happens when you actually give it your deposit. Well, I wanted to continue. We've been during this practice period, we've been talking about Atishas in the Tibetan tradition. He was actually an Indian, and then he went up into Tibet. Buddhism had already been in Tibet, but it had kind of degenerated, as often happens, into kind of ritual and not enough emphasis on practice, on meditation practice. So he kind of went up and brought, rejuvenated, a little bit of a reformation. And his teachings, the 7 points of mind training. So we're with the result of the 59 slogans. And so we've just finished the fourth class, our Wednesday night class, and we're up to about the fifth slogan. So we've spent a lot of time on the preliminaries. So the preliminaries, again, what this teaching is trying to present to us is in our spiritual practices to cultivate what is called in the Tibetan tradition. We don't have these terms so much in Zen tradition, but absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. And the first part, the first slogans, and the first part is the absolute bodhicitta, which is more focused on our meditation practice. Finding that sense of equanimity and calmness, and through meditation practice, finding our own inner light. And so when we meet the vicissitudes of the world, we have something that is our refuge, is really our true home. We're not looking to go out there to find our happiness. Our happiness, our sense of peace, lies within the integrity of our own mind and our practice. And then we find, through exploring our own pain and our own discomfort, and being able to tolerate and move towards our own soft spot, as Pema Chodron says, I love that word, our own soft spot, our own vulnerability, as we begin to develop the capacity to do that and not be lost in our own suffering, then we intuitively want to reach out and help other people, and we resonate. We develop a sense of empathy and compassion for other people. And out of that empathy comes a natural compassion and our loving kindness. So that's the more the relative bodhicitta. And we need to find in our practice a sense of balance about that. Some people are a little more inclined towards the wisdom side, and even some traditions are a little inclined more towards the wisdom side. Some are inclined a little more towards the compassion side, and we need to balance, bring a sense of balance to both, so we know ourselves, which way we need to go. And the three slogans, so we our meditation practice, just being present, watching the mind, and that quote that I gave you this morning is a really very important quote, and I really commend you to use it as a koan. To live here and now, you must train yourself. You must train yourself. You know, there are some people who have a natural ability just to be present, but most of us, given our Western education, it's not the case. We need some practice to train ourselves. In the seen, there will be just the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the sense, just the sense, and in the thought, just the thought. That is the end of sorrow. That seems so simple, that teaching. And almost all of really Buddha's teaching is included in this very elegant and simple teaching. Train your mind to keep coming back to the brilliance of the present moment. So then we have a lot of very elaborate slogans that come out of this to kind of help us do this. So the first slogan we've been working with is regard all dharmas as dreams, all mental phenomena, all thoughts. We begin to see them as dreams, all dharmas in terms of just the phenomenal world. Begin to regard them more as a dream. Lighten up. Don't attach to them so strongly. Don't concretize them. Don't make them think that they, this is the way, you're the way you project them with your own thought process, that this is really the way they are. Begin to see them. Lighten up. Begin to see a bigger perspective. Regard them as a dream. You know, more malleable, more flexible, more impermanent, which is what Buddhism teaches us. Regard all dharmas as dreams. Helping you lighten up. Don't take it so, don't be so heavy. Don't take yourself so seriously. Okay? Lighten up. There's a sense of humor in this practice and how we regard life. Okay? And the second one is, how do we do this? How do we regard all dharmas as streams? Well, we begin to examine, second slogan, we begin to examine the unborn nature of awareness. And so we talked about that a couple weeks ago. We begin, first of all, we need to develop our concentration practice. You know, it seems like the teachings of Buddhism seem so elaborate and so profound. How is it that counting from 1 to 5, how could that possibly be important? You know, there's much more important things to think about in terms of Buddhist practice. And we should wrap ourselves around these very, profound and difficult to understand koans and teaching. No, we just count the breath. We stay with the breath. Because as we stay with the breath and keep coming back to the present moment, breath, counting, our mind begins to slow down. And we begin to explore and understand, which cannot be understood through me, what I'm saying, is the unborn nature of your awareness. What is this unborn nature of life? What is this calm, abiding mind that you begin to perceive your own mind through and the phenomenal world? You begin to examine the unborn nature of awareness. There was a nice quote, I thought I'd read it to you, in the Tibetan tradition. You know, Padmasambhava was... he was sort of the Dogen. In Zen we have Dogen. But in Tibetan tradition you have Padmasambhava. When I was traveling in Sikkim, it's, you know, every mountaintop there's a temple. In, you know, Tibet, in Nepal, not so much in Nepal, but in Sikkim, Bhutan, where Padma Sambhava, you know, flew in from Tibet and just posited some teachings, and then, you know, kind of flew over to the next. So he's like the big kahuna, so to speak, in the Tibetan tradition. So here's what Padma Sambhava says about this unborn nature of awareness, this part of our mind which we begin to feel intuitively as our mind begins to calm. The mind itself is certainly empty and established, and unestablished. The mind itself is certainly empty and unestablished. Your mind is intangible, like empty space. Is it like that or not? Observe your own mind. Is it not like empty space, really, behind all the thoughts? Empty and void, but without a nihilistic sense. Empty, but without a nihilistic sense. Very alive and present. Self-arising, primordial wisdom is original, clear consciousness. Self-arising and self-illuminating. It is like the essence of the sun. Is it like that or not? Observe your own mind. The primordial wisdom of awareness is certainly unceasing. Uninterrupted awareness is like the current of a river. Is it like that or not? Observe your own mind. The dispersing discursive thoughts are certainly not being grasped. This intangible dispersion is like a hazy sky. Is it like that or not? Observe your own mind. Recognizing all appearances as self-appearing, self-appearing phenomena are like the reflection in a mirror. Is it like that or not? Observe your own mind. All signs are certainly released in their own state, self-arising and self-releasing. They are like clouds in the sky. Is it like that or not? Observe your own mind. So that all sounds hopefully both inspirational and a little intimidating. But really, in our practice, you know, and especially in our Zen practice, we just say, keep coming back to the present moment. Just whatever your mind is presenting in the present moment. And these truths will be revealed. We don't quite have the same kind of elaborate vocabulary for it, but just trust the process of coming back and being present. And these truths will be revealed. And then the third slogan, when we begin to abide more in this unborn nature of our mind, is be a child of illusion. And this is a beautiful slogan, be a child of illusion. It doesn't mean, you know, you go around being immature or that you go around confused like illusion. It means that you go around in a state of kind of purity, a sense of unencumbered ability to be present. In Zen, we call it, you know, we have words called like beginner's mind. The expert mind is closed, but the beginner's mind is open to all possibilities. So, being a child of illusion enables you to be to lighten up, to hold things lightly. Like, oh, what could this be? What could this situation possibly teach me? So, that's actually the first two steps in training of the mind, and then we begin to move into relative bodhicitta. How do we begin to take and engage with the world? So I thought I'd read just a couple things. So because what this practice is really about is it's about engaging with the world. It's not about having a sense of coming in and just creating your own sense of quietude and calm peace of mind, you know, where you're trying to keep distractions at bay. That's not what the practice is about. Buddha said, skillful means without wisdom is bondage. Which means skillful means, he means here, is like engaging in the world, trying to help people in the world. But if you don't have the wisdom of the first primary slogans, you'll have bondage, which I've experienced firsthand. I used to run a hospice program, right? And we had a lot of very deeply caring caregivers, nurses and people in the caring profession. But without a sense of wisdom and balance, it's very easy to burn out. Very easy to burn out. But then if you just have wisdom without a sense of engagement in the world, it can be kind of dry and disengaged in a kind of a self-centered sort of barrenness the teachers talk about. So you need a balance of both. It's interesting that so all of relative bodhicitta is really based on the four immeasurables. Love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and even-mindedness. And there's a great story of where people would always ask Buddha, they always come to these questions like, what happens after birth? After death. What happens after death? Where do we go? Is there a heaven? Or is there a God? And so somebody came, because in the pre-Buddhist Hindu tradition, there were many examples of gods. But God, and Buddhism is called a non-theistic religion because we don't believe that there's a God that actually created the universe. There isn't a God outside of creation. But somebody went to Buddha and said, what about God? And he didn't say, well, there isn't any God, or you should just work for nirvana. Or his answer was to this person, practice the four immeasurables. Practice the four immeasurables, and you will find God. So in other words, when we hear in our own traditions, God is love. I think that's actually what he was saying. Or when the Dalai Lama says, my religion is kindness. My religion is kindness. This is what he's saying. Practice the four immeasurables. All these are to cultivate a sense of the four immeasurables. Here's a couple from the Christian tradition. Thomas Merton, a great Christian contemplative, a Trappist monk. He says, Saints are what they are not, because their sanctity makes them admirable to others. Saints are what they are not, because their sanctity makes them admirable to others, but because the gifts of sainthood make it possible for them to admire everybody else. Mm. When a sinner sees a saint, they see a sinner. But when a saint sees a sinner, he sees a saint. Mm. Meister Eckhart, is a great mystic, Christian mystic. The outer work will never be puny if the inner work is great. Trungpa, it is the tender heart that has the power to transform the world. And here's I love this one from Thich Nhat Hanh. Love and compassion appear as selfless service. Yet in love we do not serve the other, we serve us. Love's communion brings us together in a whole. Compassion does not see the world's pain and sorrow as other. It is shared. It is ours. When we allow our shared vulnerability and humanness, love and compassion are as natural as our breath, and without hesitation, we act to help. So this is really a beautiful way of seeing it. And that's why, we start off, as I said before, with absolute bodhicitta. We start off with our own ability to be with our own pain and sorrow, and to cultivate empathy for ourselves. You know, one of the hard things in doing metta practice is when we're doing metta for other people, we can do it for other people, we can't do it for ourselves. But then we begin to disengage, and we don't see that other people's pain is connected to our pain, and our pain is connected to others. And that's why in the 7 points of mind training, Tong Lin is really a beautiful practice, because it's an exchange. The slogan says the giving and the alternate giving and sending. And it means that you touch your own pain, and through your own pain you develop empathy for yourself, but then you develop empathy for others. And that's what Thich Nhat Hanh says. It's not like, you know, a lot of people have a kind of a superior stance, like, you know, I sort of got together, or I don't have to look at my pain, and in fact I'll help other people, or I'll focus on their pain so I don't have to focus on my pain. That's a very common trap for caregivers, is to have that kind of sense of arrogance, you know, misguided arrogance. So giving and sending, touch your own, touch others. Touch others, touch your own. Understanding that it's a mutual, it's a shared pain and discomfort and suffering of the world, and that's why Buddha started. You know, his first noble truth was suffering. You know, it's not a nihilistic way to look at the world. It's a way to look at how we all, it's a shared predicament that we all deal with in terms of having to cope our shared anxiety around impermanence. So I wanted to, as we start to move into talking about loving kindness, I wanted to talk a little bit about attachment. So, you know, so if loving kindness is the heartfelt yearning for the well-being and happiness of others, you know, based on a similar yearning for yourself, and is directed to sentient beings, it's important that in the teachings that is directed towards sentient beings and not an object. Because in directing towards sentient beings, the sense of empathy, that sense of soft spot can actually be cultivated. The important thing is that often love and loving kindness is confused with attachment. And if we're really honest with ourselves, the people that we're most deeply involved with and the people that we say that we have love for, there is a strong, usually a very strong element of attachment. So important to kind of, cop to that, to acknowledge that that's actually the case, that we have a sense when we're infatuated, it's usually because we don't understand that happiness is an internal process. You know, that it's not outside objects that are going to make us happy. It's our own internal sense of how we relate to ourselves. And the more we become infatuated, the more we project out into outside objects, is that that's what's going to make us happy. That's when we begin to set ourselves up for disappointment. And, you know, as a therapist, I see that. It's like we take a sense of infatuation and a sense of attachment, and we project it out into an object, usually our significant other, and then we set ourselves up for disappointment because very important to see this process, because attachment and infatuation at first actually gives a fair amount of happiness. It actually works for a while. But then what happens is we have a distorted view. We've only projected out, in other words, we're looking to this object, an external object, to make ourselves happy. And so we've projected onto this person or it could be an object, but let's say it's a person. It could be a job, it could be a car, it could be, you know, I've got to have this thing to make myself happy. But we project that sense of my internal happiness onto this object, and then when we begin to see that that doesn't measure up, we become very disappointed. So the indicator for whether how in the equation of unconditioned love, which is what we're trying to work towards, and attachment, that combination which we bring to most of our relationships, when you begin to see how heavy the attachment part is when you begin to see that you're disillusioned. You become more and more disillusioned with that person. And that's where what bodhisattvas and saints have worked through. They're not looking to that external object to give them a sense of gratification. And so when they see the imperfection of the other person, they're so aware of their own imperfection that they see that. It's a shared situation. I often try to think of skillful ways to say this when I have couples. When somebody comes in and is just railing on against all the flaws and the difficulties of and how the other person isn't meeting their needs for love, right? And it's true. What they're seeing is the person is pretty imperfect. And you know, it's good that we actually have a dialogue and talk about it. But what's missing is the fact that they don't see, you know, how imperfect they are. And often I have an opportunity to, you know, point that out. But I have to be very skillful. And often it's after you know, many months of therapy, you know. I said, do you really think they're more neurotic than you are? That would be not a very skillful way of saying it, but in my mind, I can clearly see, you know. And it's true. We can see the other person's neurosis pretty well, but it's pretty hard to see our own. So, there's a teacher at Spirit Rock that... I read an article about him once, and he was talking about different stages of relationship. So one stage of relationship would be where you have a very heavy dose of attachment, and you really have a strong projection of this person. You have a very idealistic projection this person is going to make you happy, you know, and it's very self-centered in terms of this person there is an object to make me happy. So that's a very low functioning level of relationship, which probably most of us have slipped into at various points. Then you have the next level, where it's much more of a quid pro quo. You know, I'm here to meet your needs, and you're here to meet my needs. This is you're there to meet my needs. No, I'm into an agreement with you, and I'm going to be tracking it. You know, but the problem is you're tracking it. You know, like, wait, I've done 4 things to meet your needs, but you've only done 2 this week to meet my needs, and we better sit down and talk about this. And actually, most relationships are sort of in that realm, really, if you're really honest about it. And that's fairly adult. But then we move on to the next level of relationship, where we begin to have an independent relationship with love. We're in relationship with other people because it is cultivating our own capacity for love. And we all experience this in terms of our relationship with, say, our children, right? We're not expecting an absolute, you know, we're not saying, well, I'm only going to give it to you if you give it to me. And, I mean, even though we do get into that. Gee, I noticed you haven't called for 3 weeks. I mean, we all slip into that. But it's not, you know what I mean, that place. So we're beginning to try to cultivate that sense, this independent relationship. And then the fourth level is the level of like the bodhisattva, where they're really operating at a level of where they're just cultivating love. You know, you go into a situation and you're not looking so much for what you're getting back. But, remember, part of compassion and love is that you also are compassionate and loving for yourself. You don't put yourself into situations where you're being harmed. So that's a tricky situation, because some people actually do have a relationship where they're not getting much. And they make a conscious, wise decision to stay in that relationship. And that can work, but one has to be very careful about that, because it can also slip into codependency. And if you're going to do that, you need to have some support around that to make sure you're not misguided. You know? But most of us don't have to worry, you know, if we can just work at the second and the third level, you know, and then are. But there probably are some relationships we have with people where we really are, especially with our children, where we operate much more at that fourth level. So William James said, you know, we become what we attend to. So this Buddha would be totally in alignment with this. We are what we attend to. So watch the habits of the mind. If what you are attending to are the flaws of the other person, or you tend to have to begin to see how wrong things are with people, and it's there, right? It's not hard to find. But if that's what you attend to, that's what your mind will become. But if what you attend to is their qualities of humanness, their qualities that you begin to see them more, that you begin to see more their unconditioned nature, their potential. And you know that people that are like this, they don't seem to relate to how screwed up people are. They seem to be able to relate to just that they're a person and they just need help. And we call those people saints and bodhisattvas, or budding saints and bodhisattvas. So we become what we attend to. So if we attend to the problems and difficulties of others, the neurosis of others, and that's all we see, then we'll become very critical and kind of bitter and closed down people. So we're training ourselves. That doesn't mean we don't ignore, we don't see the whole picture, but we're attending to a bigger possibility of the person. So there are a couple ways, you know, that we practice cultivating loving kindness. We have our metta practice where we just start with ourselves. May I be filled with kindness. We wish that for ourselves. May we be free of mental and physical fear in our lives. May we be peaceful and at ease. May we be happy. May we be filled with gratitude. We use our own phrases, but these are some of the traditional phrases. And then we have Tong Lin, where we feel... Oh, one thing I haven't stressed about Tong Lin. Actually, Tong Lin works the best in intense situations. Like if you're really angry, or if you're really have a lot of anxiety, and you breathe in and feel that anxiety, really feel it, and then start to send yourself the antidote, peace, in common. The practice is much more alive for you. Or if you're with somebody, it isn't just theoretical, but you really can feel their suffering and you have the capacity to take it in a little bit, take it in, just be with it, the other person's suffering, and then send back to them. When it's a little intense is where the practice brightens up for you. But there's two other practices that I really are very important practices. One is to feel the pain of contraction. So when you're angry, instead of going to how justified you are, which is pretty easy to do, that's what happens, right? You just, this person did this, and you're right. They did, your perception's fairly clear. They did something that's pretty self-centered. And you keep repeating it, and you just notice how it just works you up. Just notice the pain. Just notice the pain. How does it feel when you're contracted? How does it feel when you're judgmental? Yeah, that's right. This person's doing this. But how does it feel? It doesn't feel good. What's the antidote? You have to move towards the antidote. You got to expand. So you just really acknowledge how bad it feels. That's a strong incentive. Pain is a very strong incentive. Okay? So that's one way to work. This is these are traditional practices. So this is, so you actually meditate on how painful it feels. Because Buddha said, one of the main quotes in the Dhammapada is, hatred never ceases through hatred. Hatred ceases through love. This is the eternal law. So we keep thinking, you know, we're going to change the situation through being our judgmental mind. But it's actually only, hatred never ceases through hatred. It only ceases through love. So that's the calling. How do we bring love into this situation? How do we do it? And the other practice is to imagine situations that create difficulties for yourself. Imagine. And then make a commitment to bring love and compassion and openness to it. Imagine. So you're driving down the road. I mean, this is a practice. You imagine driving down the road. Somebody comes, you're a little, you're not paying attention. And some, 18-year-old guy drives by in his pickup truck and honks his horn and yells at you and flips you the bird. Right? It's all happened to you, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you get pissed, don't you? You get really angry.
Yeah.
You want to just do it right back to him, don't you? Right? And you notice that. First of all, you notice how that feels. Not how justified you are, but how does it feel? The second is you practice beforehand, realizing you actually create in your mind, you visualize in your mind this is going to happen, and you practice sending understanding. Just how uptight that person is, how contracted they are, how angry they are, how much suffering they're in. And you focus on that rather than how unreasonable they are. So that's a practice that you can do. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
No, I just wondered in that situation. I mean, then you just drive with the same, rate, or you speed up.